Well, that's up to Isabel to deal with now. Okay, moving on. Cultivate patience for everyone. Completely free of irritation or resentment. And you noticed how we could all slip, very easily feel, slip into the irritation and resentment. I mean, the thing is, this is one of the things you actually learn from shamatha. Shamatha, resting, just resting with the breath. You really learn patience. How many times do you have to let go of thinking? Yeah. You know, I mean, when people start with me, after two or three things, they come and say, well, I keep getting caught up in thoughts. And said, when you've been caught by your millionth thought, we'll start to discuss this problem. Yeah. If it's still going on by then, but, you know, the first million you get on the house. Now, within these lines, those of you who are familiar with mind training, for bodhisattvas who want to be rich in virtue, a person who hurts you is a precious treasure. The corresponding line in mind training is be grateful to everyone. And so again, and cultivate patience for everyone, completely free of irritation or resentment. I mean, the only way that we do that is by experiencing the world as if it were a dream. You don't get a dream. You don't get irritated. You may get upset sometimes, but you don't get irritated at what you dream. No, it was a dream. You don't gnash your teeth afterwards and say, oh, I wish I hadn't had that dream. That's a really bad thing to... Everybody, if you do that, things people go, well, it's only a dream. No, no, I don't. I didn't want to have that dream. Okay. Listeners and solitary Buddhas...
You know what, Ken?
Yes.
The Vilarupas thing is interesting.
Do you have a mic? Chuck?
Go
ahead.
He says, for patience, nothing to do other than not fear what is ultimately true.
What's interesting about that to you?
It turns everything upside down.
Go on.
It, fear and patience, I mean, it doesn't seem to put it together, but
what's the connection?
It really turns my head around when I try to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I best I shouldn't think about it.
Well, you know how far thinking gets you.
I know. It's gotten me in a lot of trouble.
Especially here, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, take a situation, if there was one, in which you were less than patient in the last...
Right.
Week. Can you think of one?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. Now, go into your experience.
Okay.
Diane, are you paying attention? Okay. What do you experience in your body?
Okay, I'm experiencing irritation.
No, in your body first.
Oh.
Tightness,
not wanting to go there, not, you know.
No, just body.
Yeah, tightness.
What else?
Bubbling, nerves, nervousness.
Okay, so sort of
things coming
subtle
to the
tingle.
Surface.
Yeah, sort of tingly, excited agitation.
Yes.
In the body, okay. What emotion do you feel?
Like, oh, not again. I mean, like regret, okay. Resentment.
Regret, resentment, okay. Now, go into that experience of resentment. You're angry at something.
Yeah, I can feel
okay.
Angry.
Okay. Now, what are you angry about?
I'm angry with myself for being angry.
Well, that's secondary. But what are you angry about originally?
About the thing that was done.
Right.
That is repetitive and that keeps coming up and I have no control over, but I have to.
So what do you feel is going to happen to you if this keeps happening?
I'm going to become a worse and worse person.
No, not about getting angry. This thing that keeps happening, what's going to happen to you if it keeps happening?
I'm going to keep feeling this way.
Yes, you are, but is it somebody who is not repairing your window or
something like that?
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen if that window is never repaired?
Nothing.
No. That's the rational mind, but emotionally, what does it feel like?
I just want it to stop.
Why do you want it to stop?
Because I want to stop feeling this way.
Yes.
But that's, I'm sorry.
No, yeah. Why do you want to stop feeling that way?
Because it's unpleasant.
Yeah. And if you go on feeling that way, what is going to happen? Not rationally, but the emotional feeling. If I go on feeling this way, what's going to happen? You're going to kill somebody?
I wouldn't, but I might be, thinking about it.
Are you afraid of that?
I'm more afraid of the anger.
Okay. Now, are you getting the connection between fear and patience?
Yeah.
Good.
Wow.
Diane, you have any comment here?
I was just relating it to my entire day.
Yes.
And I could relate. And actually, through all of these, I was very, I think you used the word humbled. I actually thought I was a patient person, but I'm not. And so I was reminded of that over and over and over again. And I had those same sensations.
Okay. But that wasn't why I was coming back to you.
Oh.
Do you know why I was coming back to you?
No.
What did I just do with Catherine?
You made her describe her experience.
I was communicating something to her.
He was explaining, but not by explaining.
I was communicating something to her, but did I explain it to her?
No.
Okay. That's what I want.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Good.
Got it.
All right. There was a comment somewhere?
Oh, I just wanted to say that was effective. What's effective for me of quelling some anger is that one that says drive all blames into one.
Yes, that's the mind training instructions. Very, very helpful. You're responsible for everything. Oh. All of the problems in the world, all of the problems in everybody's life, all of the problems in your life, and all of the problems that anybody will ever experience are entirely due to you.
Wow.
How do you feel?
Like I'm not responsible.
Okay. Not quite the desired effect, but we'll move on. Listeners and solitary Buddhas, then these are Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. Those are the Sanskrit terms. These are creations of the Mahayanists, straw dogs that they could bat down. Listeners are people who hear the teachings, and just from hearing the teachings, they go off and practice. But according to the Mahayanists, they aren't greatly imbued with compassion. They're basically interested in their own awakening, not the other. Solitary Buddhas, slightly higher level of attainment, but a similar attitude. Listeners and solitary Buddhas, working only for their own welfare, are seen to practice as if their heads were on fire. So these people, they're only interested in getting free of the turmoil of samsara for themselves, and yet they're really putting all of their energy into it. But us who are concerned with helping all sentient beings, we're just completely lazy. To help all beings, pour your energy into practice. It's the source of all abilities. So, and I'm going to unpack the code that's in this. We go through different stages of motivation. You could say different levels of motivation. When we start practicing, most of us, we say, I want to become free of suffering. That's why I'm practicing. What I want to suggest here is that we have a very limited, a very definite, but usually quite a limited sense of what that means. I think, oh, it's just me. But as we continue to practice, we begin, through some of the things we've been discussing this evening, to appreciate that when I say I want to be free of suffering, that's coming from the sense of seeing myself separate from experience. But as I realize I'm not separate from experience, the I gets a little bit larger. And there is no possibility of I being free of experience unless, being free of suffering, unless the totality of the world that I experience is free of suffering. Oh, suddenly we're now talking about all sentient beings, which my experience of which comprises the totality of my experience. So when they're talking, as one does in the Mahayana all the time, about working for the benefit of all sentient beings, you know, and saving all sentient beings and so forth, and you get this over and over again. One way of working with that, approaching that, is you're talking about the totality of what each of us experience. We cannot separate from any aspect of our experience. And that's why in the Bodhisattva vow, for instance, one of the commitments is not to reject a single sentient being. Because if you reject a single sentient being, you're rejecting some aspect of your experience. You say, I'm not going to deal with it. And you won't wake up there because you won't deal with it. That's why it's really important. And you wanted me to talk a bit about the Bodhisattva vow, so I'm going to keep some time open for that this evening. But we're doing fine here. Pour your energy into practice. I want to say a little bit about that. All of us have chosen to live in the world and practice. None of us have chosen the monastic path to withdraw from the world, live in a monastery. None of us have chosen the hermit path.
Yet.
Yet. Things happen. Because of that choice we've made, we have to be very clear about what the word practice refers to. Most people think of practice as referring to formal meditation. But given the choice we have made, that is only a portion of our practice. And in the scheme of things, it's actually only about 5 to 10% of our practice. 5 to 10%. You got that? Now, a good 30% of our practice we spend asleep. We're not doing very much. So it means we have to make even more use of the rest of the time, because we've got to compensate for all that downtime. What's the rest of that downtime? That's our waking life, when we're not actually formally meditating. maybe should be I'm tending towards emotional reactions rather than reactive emotions these days. Reactive emotions are dismantled by insight supported by stillness. There are two qualities that you need in your attention. One is stability, which is what the stillness is referring to. But stability is where the power comes from. Insight is where that cutting quality comes from. You see into things, in Buddhist context, to see into the working of things, reactive emotions, is to see that they are simply a mechanism, that there is nothing to them, that they are not facts, they are simply movements. You with me? Okay. Now, that's actually relatively easy to see. Even a bit of cognitive behavioral therapy will help you with that one. But without the stability to maintain that knowing, you just get lost. So it's a combination of those two that leads to the disengagement and the dismantling of reactive emotions. So you cultivate meditative stability that passes right by the four formless states. The four formless states are very, very high levels of stability. Your mind becomes so stable that even the subtlest concepts having form or not having form don't arise, and those are the names of them. The first is infinite space. I'm getting really rusty. I used to know all of the stuff by heart. Pardon?
Second is infinite consciousness.
That's right. Third is?
Third is nothing at all.
Nothing at all? I think it's nothing and not nothing, actually. Okay.
And neither existent nor non
existent, yeah. Those are the four formless states, and they refer to very, very still states of mind in which you think you are enlightened. But your mind is just really, really still. And there's and why it says here is that it passes right by. What these very still states of mind are lacking is that seeing quality, the clarity quality, which comes through insight. They're just being really, really still, like really calm ocean. And as you hear from the descriptions, they're very subtle. Then, finally, 30. Without wisdom, the five perfections are not enough to attain full awakening. They're not enough to attain full awakening because they're simply ordinary actions without that quality of being awake, empty, whatever, non-separation, all of these terms we were throwing around at the beginning of this evening. That's why you cultivate wisdom, this quality of knowing, endowed with skill, and free from the three domains. Now, this is a wonderfully formal phrase, which you will come across time and time again in the Tibetan tradition. You'll see it in the three spheres or things like that. What are they? They are the action, the acted on, and the subject of the action. The acted on, yeah. Now, what does it mean to be free of the three domains? Well, Jessica earlier this evening gave an example where she saw something and did, and there wasn't a sense of I am doing this for this person. That was my understanding. Yeah. Okay. That's all it means. If you want it really simply, it's acting without a sense of self. No, it is not something you can try to do. Because as soon as you try to do it, you're right in that sense of self. It's wonderful.
Can you say those three things again? Action?
The action, acted on, and actor.
Okay.
So you'll see that phrase over and over again. And a lot of people think it means this completely inaccessible state of high awakening. No, it's the thing about the awakened mind is it's already present. And we probably experience it 10,000 times a day. How many times do we miss it? About 999. And those of you who studied with me or started studying with me, you know what my first meditation instruction to you was. Return to what is already there and rest. Remember that? Okay. What is already there? Trick question. What is already there? What is already there? Anybody? Absolutely nothing. Return to that and rest. That's the perfection of wisdom. And when you act in the perfection of wisdom, that is, you're generous or whatever, that's what makes generosity the perfection of generosity. And it takes it out of the ordinary karmic process of generating good results into experiencing being awake. Okay. Now, just a few minutes. Any questions? Is this helpful to you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much. For those of you who want Manarepa, for meditative stability, nothing to do other than rest and presence. He makes it sound so easy, doesn't he? For wisdom, nothing to do other than know directly how things are. Okay. Now, Bodhisattva vow. In the Tibetan tradition, there are three levels of vows. One says ordinations, but that's not really accurate, that they're vows. They're things you undertake to do. The first is the monastic level, which is called the vows of individual freedom, which have to do with specific actions. This is what a monk or nun take, fully ordained monks, 253 or 256, and the 253, I think in the nuns there's 356 or something like that. You can ask Tanasanti, remind me to speak to you about Tanasanti.
356 things you can't do.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Men only have 253. It's, you know, monk chauvinism once again. There's but they come down to the five basic precepts, which are not to take, the actual precepts are not to take human life, not to steal more than a week's worth of rice, or anything that is valued more than a week's worth of rice. Not to lie about your spiritual attainments. Not to have sexual intercourse if you're a monk or nun, and to not to commit adultery if you're a lay person. And not to take anything that's been fermented. which is usually interpreted as not to take intoxicants. Those are the actual vows, and they're extended to the general principles of not to take life, not to steal, not to lie, to have appropriate sexual relationships, and so forth. No, there's a tradition of lay, lay precepts, which you can take, but you actually do have to take them from a representative of the monastic tradition. So that's why I don't give them, because they're embodying it very fully. At least that's my understanding. The bodhisattva, but these are concerned, as you see, with very specific actions. And the saying is that the monastic the individual freedom ordination is like a clay pot. Very useful, it provides a container for your practice, but when you break it, it's broken. Bodhisattva vow, in contrast, is a vow of intention. Doesn't concern specific actions. And you're making the promise or the vow to wake up, which it means to become Buddha, in order to help other beings become Buddha. Wake up. How many beings? All other beings. So, in the way that I was talking earlier, it is the intention to wake up completely in the totality of your experience. And it's given this mythical quality, which is really, really powerful, because when you take this vow, you know, it isn't good for this life, it's good for all time. It isn't confined to any locality. It governs all possibilities of experience anywhere and everywhere. So it's very big and it's very huge. And there are two aspects. There are a couple of aspects to this awakening. One is you're awakening to what is ultimately true, which is emptiness, nothing. And you're also waking up what is apparently true, which is compassion as the expression of emptiness, as the expression of awareness, not compassion as an emotion, it's a higher level of compassion. That part of the intention is further broken down into the vow to intend to wake up and then the vow to work at waking up, which you can regard as the difference between intention and will, if you wish. One is saying, I intend to wake up, and the other is saying, I'm doing this. Not I'm going to do this, but I'm doing this. And so you start engaging the actual act and using whatever arises in your experience to wake up. That's why I say that moves it from the level of intention to the level of will. You're just going to do it, and that's that. So when you take the bodhisattva vow, you're making a commitment. And primarily you're making a commitment to wake up. And who is the one person that's affected by that? You. Now, there are all kinds of do's and don'ts associated with this. And I've said it's, but all of those are things that support that intention. It's said that if you violate your bodhisattva vow, it's like, or the bodhisattva vow is like a crystal vase, not a clay pot, but a crystal vase. You break it, and it's still beautiful. The intention continues. Now, what constitutes breaking the bodhisattva vow? Well, the intention aspect is actually only broken by harboring or staying in two states of mind for more than 2 hours, or either of two states of mind for more than 2 hours. What are those two states of mind? One is despair. I can't do this. When you say, I can't do this, you're denying your own Buddha nature. And 2 hours or so, 2 to 4 hours is the time. That's long enough for it, you start taking that seriously and fixing it in you. So I can't do this, so I'll never be able to do this. That violates it in one way. The other is what I mentioned earlier this evening, is to reject a sentient being. What does it mean, reject a sentient being? It doesn't mean to say, I don't want to have anything to do with you. It is, I will never help you come what may ever again. That's what rejecting a sentient being and holding that attitude and saying, I don't care what happens, I'm never going to help you again. Anyway, whatsoever. And you can see how that is just blocking out a part of your experience, something you don't want to deal with in here. And that's why it violates the intention, because you've just said to yourself, I'm not going to wake up in this area. Whatever button this person's pushing in me, I don't care. I'm not going to wake up. And several years ago, I ran into this. I was having a discussion with a colleague of mine who'd run into some problems, and I won't go into the details. And we were talking about it. And he was describing a situation, and there was a very specific point in the process that he had made a choice, and the choice had been disastrous. And so I asked him the question, which I would ask any of you, what was going through your mind at that point? You know, and those of you who've worked with me individually know that's the kind of question I ask. What were you actually experiencing right then? Because there's those little points in our lives where everything changes. I think they're kind of important. I said, I don't know. And I was really surprised that this person had no interest in that particular moment. And that just struck me as very, very strange. And from my point of view, it's not really about indicating a problem with respect to this bodhisattva vow. One of the aspects of what I have found personally about the bodhisattva vow is the longer you have it, the more deeply it bites. So one thing, it means you get curious. You've promised to be curious about every aspect of your experience where you're not present. Okay, nobody wants to take it now. Okay. Another thing, there was a situation I was involved in back in the early 90s, which I was finding very difficult. And through it, I came to understand another aspect of the bodhisattva vow, at least for me, and that was, you don't get to indulge your own confusion anywhere. Okay? In any circumstance. You know, there's no place you get to indulge. There's no vacation. You don't get to indulge your own confusion. I mean, are you going to fall down 100 times? Yes, that's why it has the analogy of the crystal vase, you know, but every piece, you know, and you keep breaking it and it keeps breaking, but every piece is still a beautiful crystal. And so it doesn't lose its clear, beautiful quality. And that's the intention. And now the third level of ordination is the bodhisattva, is the Vajrayana vow, and which is likened to a gold pot. It doesn't matter how badly it gets beaten up, it's still gold. Atisha said of these three vows, how have you done with your ordinations or your vows? Atisha was once asked this, and he said, well, the individual freedom, never broke it. Bodhisattva vow, Every 2 or 3 hours. Vajrayana?
Like rain.
Very hard. No.
That's samaya.
Yeah, samaya. Now, I missed one piece here. For the bodhisattva vow, there's also the vow of at the level of will, of engagement. And for some reason, I can never remember these. And I've struggled to remember them over and over again, which is why I brought this book along. And there are the four black dharmas. Dharmas. The four black actions. Right, yeah, they have four black diamonds, right? Dharmas. Yeah. Well, maybe easier this way. Such a terrible index. Okay, I'm not going to find it there. Here we go. Ah, I can't find them. Ah, here we are, the four dark actions. Got them. Chapter 10 at the end. Oh, I was looking in the wrong chapter. That helps. Okay, the four dark actions, the four black things. Yeah, they're quite straightforward, and you can see why they violate the will to awaken, as opposed to the intention. The intention is violated by lapsing into despair or rejecting a sentient being. The will to is destroyed by deceiving your spiritual teacher. Why is that? Well, if you're going to deceive your spiritual teacher, what are you doing to yourself? You're lying to yourself at a really profound level. You know, you're lying to yourself at the very core of your being. You know, you're lying to yourself about your own spiritual attainments. That's what it takes to lie to your teacher. The second is making someone feel ashamed about good they've done. Yeah. They've tried to do good. Maybe it's been completely stupid, but if they've tried to do good, that's the intention, and you make them feel ashamed, you're undoing any ability to rejoice in their good work and to celebrate goodness. So you're undermining that will in you. The third one is to denigrate anyone who has formed the intention to awaken. And say, oh, they're no good, they're bad. And now, we denigrate people because we're basically angry. So, we're acting out of anger against what we ostensibly value most, which is the intention to awaken. So you can see how it works very much against one's own will. And the fourth one is to intentionally deceive other people. Whenever you deceive, whenever you are intentionally deceiving another person, you are making that person an object in your world of experience. You're no longer relating to them as a person. Again, it's violating the will to be awake. So, the vow is significant, but what I want to stress here is that it's a vow of intention. Will you violate it? All the time. It's why one takes it and renews it all the time. So it's not like you can never have a bad thought again. You're going to. But it's how you're going to relate to that bad thought. You know, and there are people, I mean, there's a person I know here in Los Angeles who's never taken the Bodhisattva vow because she just doesn't want to take on that responsibility. For myself, this has been when I was back in Sonoda, Rinpoche's monastery. Maybe it's just my craziness, but when I heard about the Bodhisattva vow, I just said, I want to do that. That makes sense to me. And you know, and I had about that much understanding at that point. And I found that when I first came to Los Angeles, I came here for about a month. The center that I was supposedly taking over was, I arrived in time to pack it all up because the house that was being rented had been sold, and so we had to move out of there. Do you remember that?
Yes.
All that tar on the ceiling?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. Because the lama before me had insisted on butter lamps, so the ceiling of this house was covered with soot. And we had to clean everything up. Oh. And then I went up and taught I went up to Vancouver and taught this text at a 10-day retreat, or 10-day or 1-week retreat. And then I was coming back to Los Angeles and really going to start from scratch. And so I made a point of coming through Seattle went to see Dajun Rinpoche, I mentioned before, and I'd asked him if he would give me the Bodhisattva vow because I wanted to renew it because I was coming here and going to start into the work of actually teaching Buddhism here. And I knew that Dajun Rinpoche was not particularly well at this point, so I said, just give me the short ceremony, you know, the 10-15 minute one. Because I mean, it can be like a 10-15 minute ceremony, or if you really do it, it can be a 1-week ceremony. You know, and you do big offerings one day and do things like that, building up lots and lots of merit before you take the actual vow. There were just three of us, the person, a friend of mine who'd driven me down to Seattle, and one other person, one of Dajun Rinpoche's students in Seattle. And we started into the ceremony. I went on. And on, and on, and on. And it was a complete transmission of, and there are two main streams of the Bodhisattva vow, one from Shantideva and one from Asanga. And so I went through all of this. And it was very nice ceremony. And at the end of it, Dajun Rinpoche said, Ken asked me to give him the Bodhisattva vow, and that's what we did today. He asked me to give just a short ceremony, which was very kind of him. It was very considered. But I've decided to give him the long ceremony because now it's his turn. And then he handed me the text for the vow. And that's the text that I use when I give the Bodhisattva vow. So I hope that gives you some background on it. And what's actually involved with it? I've stressed what the commitments are, you know, what you and the nature of that. I mean, there's the 46 things you're meant to do, and the 18 thises, which are broken up into the 5 of this, the 5 of that, and the 8 of that. You know, the 5 like a king, 5 like a minister, and 5 like I can't remember the 8 like something else. And You know, there's all kinds of stuff connected with it, but what I've tried to give you this evening is the essence. Okay? So we're doing that, I gather, from Deborah's email on the 27th. So we'll do that in the evening. Okay. So, what do we do next week? Yeah, firstborn, everything you own, whatever. Generally speaking, I mean, that's... one... You make offerings not as an expression of generosity, and the expression of generosity is a way of generating goodness in yourself, which creates the right conditions in you to form this intention and to make this commitment. That's the purpose there. Part of the reason it took so long with Dajun Rinpoche is that I was translating it all at the same time. We'll start at 7:30 and it'll go to about this, and probably go to about 9:30. We'll do our meditation beforehand. It'll be about the same. That's what I'm anticipating anyway. Okay. So we just have two more classes, right? Two? Is that right? Ooh. Where did all the time go? So... Well, I suggest then that we do. Well, actually, the next four correspond pretty closely to the four black actions. So let's do the next four, and then on the 20th we'll do the last three and the concluding verses. Okay?
Four black actions?
Yeah, four black dharmas, the ones I was talking about. Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure they correspond precisely, but they're pretty close. So we'll do the next four verses, and then we'll do the next three and the concluding verses on the 20th. Okay? Very good. Thank you very much. Dedication?